Very good morning to everybody. As you've probably gathered from the last hour, it takes quite a lot to cow Lindsay and myself, but because we, you know, we usually have, you know, peewee-minded showbiz type pitching up here. No offence. But today, Piers Sellers joins us. Three-time space shuttle traveller and captain, I suspect. I don't know what the actual term is. Piers, welcome aboard the show. And the kind of awe that people approach an astronaut with, and I think it's entirely, of course, warranted and valid.
Oh, I'd love a bit of awe.
You're going to get plenty of it here. Should have a winding sheet around our jaws because, you know, we broadcast a little dog and pony show on the radio. You're an astronaut. Does it strike you as a routine job or something you've got used to, or do you actually look at yourself sometimes and think, not bad, astronaut?
Ooh, I can't believe my luck.
That's
right, it does. I hung it up, you know. I hung it up about a year ago.
Yeah, but you did it three times. That's plenty.
Now I'm a scientist bureaucrat.
Yeah.
Which is okay. And I like the spooky music in the background.
It's all we can do to add to the awe. But seriously, when you, what age did you suddenly look up in the sky and think, that's where I belong?
About seven.
Were you really?
No kidding. It really was, right at the beginning of the space age. And I saw all these things on TV, you know, the Gemini program, and the Apollo program, the landing on the moon, all that stuff. It was fabulous. I thought, this is great. Yeah. That's what I'd love to do.
Yeah, but we all did that.
Some of us wanted to be engine drivers, you know.
Yeah, but as I say, but those childhood dreams, you know, the one thing is having them, therefore dreams.
Not many,
but the
actually
other,
make it happen.
Exactly. And I know you entered through a meteorological route, didn't you?
Did a bit of meteorology and climate simulation, stuff like that. Then the clerical errors in my favour. I eventually got in. It was good.
But that's what I understand. You apply to be an astronaut.
Yeah,
What does it actually say on the application?
It took three times. In my case, all right. So I got it in the third attempt.
And what is the application like?
Question number one: are you a U.S. citizen? Yes, no.
I was no.
So until I could check that box, yes, you know, you couldn't proceed to question two, which is all the rest of it. You know, and the other 900 questions. So I became a U.S. citizen when I moved over to the States.
And are there, like, physical restrictions on it?
I'm afraid so, yeah. Luckily, not too many mental restrictions. I managed to get in.
I heard this once, Lindsay, that no astronaut can be below 6 feet tall. Am I confusing that with
you? No.
That's what I've
told. I think there's everybody between, 4 foot, I don't know, just under 5 foot and all the way up to 6 foot two.
Well, let me ask you this then. Here's something, and the questions will get broad and dumb, but sometimes the answers yield fruit. Space suits, they are fitted, I take it. They're made especially for you, or are they off the peg?
No, unfortunately not. They're kind of off the peg.
No.
That's right. Are you a size six or not, sir?
No.
That's right, yeah. And there you go. That's right, your left leg's a little short. We'll have to.
But surely they burn them when they return to Earth.
The spacesuits they come range of sizes, small, medium, extra large, and all the rest of it.
No.
And then there you go.
And inside, are they hollow inside?
There's two kinds. There's the kind of orange suit that you go up and down in the shuttle with, you know, which is like a pressure suit. Just protects you in case you take a hole in the spacecraft. And then there's the big white suit for spacewalking, which is almost like a suit of armor. Now, those you've got a range of, like, pants and gloves and, torsos and things like that. So you kind of clip it together, different sizes to make it fit the right person.
And before you actually, and we've got the photograph on the wall behind us here of the classic, you know, the huge reflective visor, and you're walking in space.
That
there.
Gold visor worth more than I paid in a year, I tell you.
Gold?
And I wasn't allowed to take it home.
Is it gold?
It's gold plated to reflect the sun's rays, yeah.
Your job just gets better and better. But is there like a fitting room you go along to and a team of assistants dress you? Is that how it works?
Yeah, but it's a once only deal. You have to take an oath not to get too fat or too thin after that, or taller or shorter. And they do it once, size you up, and it's good to go.
My understanding, and I don't know where I picked this up, and bear in mind it's no understanding at all, is that what those suits, because they may have picked up some space infection, they have to be got rid of afterwards, and the whole thing.
Well, those aliens are a problem. There's a particular nasty one that looks like a steak and kidney pie.
I'm trying to find out stuff.
And occasionally they come in and hit people's windshields, but you should ignore that.
You use those space suits again and again.
For example, the first time I went did a spacewalk was 2002.
Yeah,
and the spacesuit that I wore the first time that was used, I think, was in 1986.
And do you know,
Yeah, I knew all the previous owners and all the previous guys who had used the suit. Yeah. So those things cost $30 million each. So they
how much?
$30 million each, first basic. So you research, you know, you look after it, and you know how many we have?
Go on.
10.
Well, I'm going into that business.
We have 10 left.
If anyone's looking to start a new career out, they're going to the space suit business. One suit man.
That's right. There's only 10 suits left.
Okay, so where were you when you got the okay? They said, yeah, you're going. You're going walking in space. And this is obviously to ignore the incredible facility you have for being an engineer in space.
Well, this is a trick question.
Why?
Well, of course, I was working at my desk when I got told, hey, you're on a mission and, you know, you're going to get 3 spacewalks on your first mission.
Did it come out of the blue, so to speak? Did you pretty much.
Well, I knew I was in line for a mission. I've been working in the astronaut office for a few years, 4 years. So my turn was somewhere out there. And I've been waiting patiently.
And then
the boss called in. He says, hey, you know, we've got a mission for you and you get to go spacewalking too. So terrific deal.
And once you've been given the okay, I take it an entire procedure starts. You're going to be here.
That's right.
What are the basics they tell you? I mean, and what qualifies somebody to tell you what you're going to do?
Well, you get a lot of basic training. So you try on different things and you get shown a little bit of everything. So everyone has to learn how to, operate the shuttle, all the systems on the shuttle. Everyone gets a little chance of running around in the pool with a spacesuit on.
What do you mean? What pool?
Well, we have this big pool, this big tank. It's about, 50 foot deep water, right, and 200 foot by 100 foot. It's got a scale model of the space station in there. And you put someone in a spacesuit, pump it up with air, chuck them in the water.
Wow.
And you weight them so they don't sink and they don't float. They just hover in the water, right? And that's the closest you get to being weightless on Earth. That's how you train someone to do spacewalking.
But does there have any real correlation with what it's actually like?
It's not bad. It's not perfect because, when you flop over on your side, you fall to the bottom of the suit. And that doesn't happen in space. You kind of float around in the middle of your suit. But it's a pretty good analog. Yeah.
The first time then you took that step outside of the craft to be weightless in space.
Yeah.
Apart from the blood rushing through your head at 100 miles an hour.
And, you know, the 2001 theme tunes sundering away in the background. Yeah.
Is there a sensation that you can anticipate? Was it just... I can't imagine. None of us can. The handful of people, literally a handful of people who'd experienced that. Did it live up to the hype in your head?
I'll tell you what happened to me. I was the guy opening the hatch in the airlock. And, first time out, so I open the hatch and I'm looking down and there's a Pacific going by 200 miles below me, 5 miles a second, like that. And then, you wait for a minute while they check out all the systems. They said, okay, out you go. So I grab the handrail and stick my head out and I go down head first out the bottom of the spacecraft. Head first, and the hatch is on the bottom of the spacecraft and you kind of go head first towards planet Earth.
Are your feet attached to something?
No, your feet just float out after. You've got a tether on. A little bit of string, cheap, nasty, frayed string.
No, that's right.
But I got tremendous vertigo. The first time I went out, I felt that everything was upside down, left was right.
For
the first 10 seconds.
Because you were hanging miles and miles and miles.
This is very weird. And then everything went... After about 10 seconds, everything locked up, and I suddenly realized, everything's the right way up. There's the world spinning below me. Big silver spacecraft. There's a big black sky, black sky and a white sun, beautiful view, and I'm scooting around the planet at 5 miles a second. Just fabulous.
Can you actually pick anything out at 5 miles a second?
No kidding. I mean, you can see pretty well everything. You can see cities, you can see, you can't see aeroplanes, but you can see the contrail, and you can slowly see a contrail from aeroplanes going across the Atlantic, very slowly inching their way across. You can see that. And how about mountains, rivers.
How about the Great Wall of China? Is that a cliche?
Never seen the Great Wall of China. I looked for it. It wasn't there. But, the Thames see it really easily.
No.
Yeah. And London, particularly London at night, all the city lights of Europe, every little town you can pick out.
What about the temperature?
In my spacesuit? Oh, it's very nice, my spacesuit.
So that's regulated?
It's air-conditioned, yeah. You've got a little fan that's whining.
Lindsay, it costs £30 million.
That's right. I'm very uncomfortable. Couldn't you spend another $1 million and make this nice?
We'll be right back with a million questions at 5 miles an hour, a second rather, after the cricket, please. Let's see what's happening. Alison. Piers Sellers, who are three-time journeyer on the space shuttle. What about time in space? Because, you have to what you watch if you go over the channel. You have to put it back. You go to New York. Is there...
Day and night.
Is there a space time? What happens to time?
Well, that's a good question.
Bless you.
Yeah, because, you know, you're going around the planet 10 times a day. Mm. So every you know, 90, 100 minutes, you whip around the planet. And if you're doing a spacewalk, you see, you know, three sunrises and three sunsets during your spacewalk, in and out of... You're flashing in the day and night as you're going around. So we stick to GMT, pretty much.
You're kidding.
There you go.
Oh.
It's bedtime stories around about 10 o'clock, cocoa, you know, fluffy bunny slippers, but and then into bed by 11.
But the sensation of time, does that alter?
Not really. You know, you're pulling 16-hour days, so you're working really hard, and you know, you're pretty beat by the end of all that. And hop into your sleeping bag, which is probably nailed to the ceiling or the wall. It can be wherever you want.
Let's deal with some of the cliches, because that's all, you know, us Earthlings have. Life on board the shuttle, is it? Are there home comforts? Is it designed like a hotel room in any way?
Well, like depends what kind of hotel you're staying in. Yeah, there you go.
So, with lots of Velcro.
That's right. So it's six guys or seven guys, you know, or gals in basically in the back of a Volkswagen bus. That's about the size of it. You know, it's very, very cramped. The shuttle is very cramped. But when you get on orbit, you're weightless, so that, you know, typically two of you sleep on the ceiling, two of you sleep on the wall, and one sleeps in the ditch by the airlock.
This is exactly like
two
guys student digs, of course.
No, I mean, it's perfect. You can stack people and park them anywhere you want.
Is that true? Because you see that, and I wonder whether, again, that's just a cliche, that you float around and...
You do. And everything else floats, you know, and your food floats. If you put it down and you take your eye off it, damn, it's gone.
And do you sleep where did
it hang? No, you sleep rubbish. That was my biggest problem every time with sleeping, because, you know, every time you close your eyes, you just feel like you've jumped off a 10-story building.
What do you mean? What do you mean by that?
Well, because you're floating, right? So the only time you float or feel like you're floating on Earth is if you jump and fall. So you feel like you're falling. So you watch people falling asleep, and they kind of, their heads sort of drop down. They suddenly go, they startle, and eyes go wide open. What just happened?
So it's fractured sleep
all the
time.
All you have to do is you either have to take sleep medication, or you Velcro yourself to the wall, tie yourself to the wall really tight, so you've got some pressure on your body, and you think you're at home in bed, and that kind of works.
Do you dream now? I know you've not, you've retired from it, but do you dream now you're back in space?
I do. I dream about the floating, because that's such an unusual, weird thing.
Yeah.
I dream about the views. And the other dreams I get are about sort of extremes of light and darkness. People are talking to me, and their faces are brightly lit up on one side and dark on the other, just like they are in space.
Well, what is sunrise like in space?
It's like a nuclear weapon going off. You know, you're outside working with little floodlights, for example. You know, you're in a spacesuit outside the spacecraft working away. And it's all black except for the floodlights on the station, this little island of light. And then you see a very thin blue line. Somebody gives you a warning saying, hey, like, you know, 60 seconds to sun up. Put your visor down, gold visor down, so, you know, don't get your eyes hurt. And then, you know, you see a very thin blue line. Then you see a white flash, and this white flash goes, pew! And it looks like a bomb going off. And then the sun comes up. And because you're going so fast, the sun climbs in the sky. You see it. You see this white sun in a black sky just climbing like that. You can see it moving. And all the shadows around you move because the sun's moving so fast.
But you see, it must have a philosophical impact on you. You must look down at the planet and they want to appear trite and just, you know, hear about who's currently trying to kill who and bombs going up. Does it make you philosophical? You look down and say, you dopes, you're given, you know, 75, 80 summers on this thing.
Yeah.
Does it make you in any way like
that?
There
is some of that. I mean, you realise that the little ball below you, everybody you know is on that thing. And the planet's pretty small. You go around it in 100 minutes and you see the whole thing. And when you look down there, you can see cities that you know.
Yeah.
And see the layout. And there's the Thames and there's the south coast of England. It's all places I've known and been to. But you whip around the whole planet in an hour and a half. So it's a very small place. It really is.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the only planet we got.
What is... have you ever actually screamed in space to see if that's true? If anyone could hear you?
Yes, I've screamed in space occasionally, you know.
The playfulness as well. Do you ever find yourself just thinking, what, this is terrific?
It is. Yeah. I mean, floating around never gets old. That's a lot of fun. You can have endless fun playing around, trying to float your way all the way down the space station from one end to the other without touching anything. You know, 100 feet.
And another cliche is the food are these hyper pills and dry ice cream. Has that come on? The space food still like that?
No. Space food's pretty much MREs, you know, military rations. Yeah. Not very good. Fortunately, though, the Russians have pretty good food. They have canned food, so there's a sort of trade that goes on where we trade, and I can't mention the brand name of coffee, a high street coffee that's pretty good.
Yeah.
We trade that for a lamb hot pot from the Russians. And there's a brutal cross-border trading that happens on space station. Where they get their love of the bean satisfied.
Okay, we
get the lamb hot pot.
Who'd have thought would all live so long when the Russians have got the good food? That shows.
Well,
they've been doing
this for 30 years. Yeah. Living on space station, so they've learned a thing or two.
We haven't actually nailed it down. What are your duties? What are you sent up to do? What do you do? What have you done while you're there?
Well, you know, the class that I joined up with in 1996, we were the biggest ever astronaut class, 35 of us. Mm. We're called the Sardines. As a result. Mm-hmm. And our career, pretty much from mine was sort of 96 to 2010, our careers were totally dedicated to building space station. It wasn't there when we showed up, and it was finished when we left as a class, pretty much. So that's what we did.
You know, 30 shuttle loads
went up there, we bolted it all together, put it together, crewed it, and that's what we did.
And I've read in the notes that you say that anytime we go to Mars or beyond, we would have to build the craft in space.
Yes.
And you could do that.
Yeah. We've demonstrated that we can build a 500-ton vehicle in space. No problem. Thank you very much. Just give me the wrench.
Or
the spanner. There you go.
What else needs to happen, though, before we can do that? What's not
actually
ready?
Look, the biggest showstopper right now, besides money, is radiation. When the Earth's got a very strong magnetic field around it, and that keeps a lot of the nasty high-energy particles called galactic cosmic radiation, which will go right through you.
Mm.
Not good for you. And Earth's magnetic field keeps that stuff away, even at the altitude of the space station. When you go out between Earth and the Mars, that heavy stuff hits you.
Yeah.
So the radiation load's kind of severe. We haven't figured out how to lick that yet. Well, working on it.
Here's something that, it may hit you as trite, but it's got to happen. Do you keep an eye out for, quote, something? And before you leave, they say, if you see something, this is the drill. Is there that possibility always in the back of your mind? You're going to look off and say, hell, what's that?
Oh, well, you know, because of my oath in the astronaut office, I'm not allowed to talk about the times I've been savaged.
What
is that funny looking egg in the corner of my space record? I think I'll lean over and have a look.
Now all of a sudden I'm being sent up. I was doing
no,
so well.
No, let me tell you. Let me tell you what we know.
Go on.
Because it's good. We found 1,700 planets around other stars. That's a lot.
That's a lot of planets.
Every star we look at, pretty much, we see planets around it. Now, our equipment's only good enough to detect mainly big ones like super Jupiters and things like that. So, you know, finding very small Earth-sized planets is a real challenge, but we're getting the techniques and the scopes to do that. But, for instance, Alpha Centauri, which is our nearest star, 4 light years away, nothing. Okay? We found a rocky planet around that. It's a hot one, but there's probably some cool ones further out. So it looks like the universe is a lot more like here than we thought before. Most stars have solar systems.
But are you trained to ignore things, you know, because anyone's mind would go racing. You think, what's that? And I know there's a lot of junk floating around the planet.
Oh, you mean, yeah.
You must obviously apply yourself to the job in hand and not go up there like a tourist, even though that must be overwhelming to just scan the horizon.
Well, occasionally you get the opportunity. So, yeah, we go out there and we're on a timeline. You know, if you're doing a spacewalk, for example, out the hatch, and, you know, every few seconds is scheduled because it costs so much and there's so much to do. So you're cranking away, working really hard. But occasionally they'll say, hey, we have to wait for a minute while we turn the power off on something. You're going to work, you know, Piers, just sit there and think deep thoughts for 2 minutes. So you go and you go, wow, great.
And you've got
just take
down
in the view.
And is it as crowded up there as we're led to believe?
You mean space junk?
Yeah.
Well, you know, you can't really see it because if space junk that's flying around is sort of crossing your path at about 1 mile per second relative speed. So if it hit you, it'd really make your eyes water.
I'd say so.
But I always made sure that I had someone else sitting in front of me when I was spacewalking.
Yeah.
You know, well, to absorb.
You're smart. You've been up there before.
There you go.
You did it three times. Piers, would you be good enough to stick around for 10 more minutes?
Yeah.
Because I've barely touched on this list here, and I've got to tell you, we're not going to get this opportunity again in a while. As one of the first people who's not been on a stand-up tour in ages. But thank you. Piers Sellers will join us again after the news headlines. But what's happening up in the sky there, please, Sarah? What's happening?
Well, it's a bit of a case of four seasons in one day.
Saturday mornings with Danny Baker on 5 Live.
Very good morning to everybody. Piers Sellers is happily still with us, hogging the microphone. As scientists say, you give some people an autoparsec and they'll take 16.093 teraangstroms. Oh, I do my science research, thank you.
Very, very good.
Three times journeyer on the space travel, engineer in space, could build a spacecraft from scratch in space at any time. We've heard that this morning. But extraordinary, Sarah, you have a connection here. Whether Sarah, what do you got for us?
Indeed. Mm-hmm. I believe that Piers and I actually went to the same school.
Oh, really?
Went to the same school in Kent.
Cranbrook?
Oh, yeah. The secret salute. That's right.
There you go. What are the chances?
I know. What are the chances
really
of that?
Good so place.
It is good
a
place.
Small it's school, small world. Place for the poor children of Cranbrook. That's
indeed
what it was founded for.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then, with all due respect to your office, you did meteorology, and then that's how you started.
Yeah, yeah.
He's an astronaut. You're working at 5 Live.
What happened there? What's going wrong?
I'm a bureaucrat now.
Oh, you keep saying that, but believe me, you're the fellow who went into space three times. Just quickly, we were talking about mnemonics earlier on, and one of yours comes from your school, doesn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. We had a science teacher called Mr. Vickers. I'm sure, probably not the same teacher. I'm not sure that's been there when Pierce was there. But he was teaching us about the lineup of the planets. And so his random mnemonics was, Mr. Vickers eats Mars bars, jumping slowly under newborn polecats.
Yeah. You know, it's easier to remember the actual names
really
of the planets.
Good. The polecats are sticking in my mind after this.
Thank you very much indeed, Sarah. So, three time on the space shuttle, and it's not always the same space shuttle either, is it? It's the space shuttle changes. It's a different craft.
We built five.
Yeah,
I've flown on two out of the five, which was Atlantis and Discovery. Atlantis twice, Discovery once. Never got to fly on Endeavour, which was the nice new shuttle with a new shuttle smell. You know, that's right, yeah. I mean, people go and say, oh, God, this is a nice, shiny shuttle.
I think
the bathroom fixtures were fabulous.
I'll bet.
But I was on Discovery, which is the oldest one.
Out of the two you travelled on, do you have a preference?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. The first one I went on was Atlantis, which I loved. And it's now at Kennedy Space Center in Florida. You go see it. But all of them on the inside are kind of banged up. You know, multiple crews have been through their training and flying them in space.
Have you ever broken anything while on board?
I think any NASA lawyers listening right now. Yeah, I have a couple of things. Unfortunately.
Let me ask you this question, Piers, before we come to something Lindsay are holding from listeners. It's a question, I guess, I don't know, I suppose that an astronaut must think. If they said to you, look, there's a mission we want you to go, but you won't come back from it, you'll just keep going, but we think you're going to see something no one else would. And again, it's a science fiction question, but they said, we want you to try this mission, but you'll just be able to send back data. As a scientist, would you think, I'll do that, I'll leave Earth, and I'm going to do something valuable. Would you take that question aboard and say...
The first thing you think, there has to be some tax advantage to this.
There you go. Smart.
No, no, but actually, probably not. I like living, and I like living on Earth.
Yeah.
I love space travel. And, you know, I'd love to go somewhere and then come back.
I see. But then this Planet of the Apes thing, then, isn't it for you?
But, you know, it's going to be tough for astronauts in the future. To get to Mars and back is about nearly 3 years. To go to Titan and back is probably 9 years.
Yeah.
So people will have to do this. They'll have to, you know, knuckle down and do this.
How long in total have you been in space?
Only about a month and a half.
Only about a month and a half.
That's a
pretty good holiday.
Yeah.
What you got there, Lindsay?
Well, Stuart says, wonderful listening to Piers, but I've got a question about being weightless in space. When you are upside down, does the blood rush to your head like it does here on Earth? And Stuart says, I could listen to this all day.
Well, believe me, this is a rare opportunity.
Well, no, it doesn't. When you first get into orbit, actually, you know, you go from being crushed in your seat from the acceleration of launch to floating free in, a zillionth of a second as the engines cut off. So then you're floating, and you're floating for the next few weeks, or however long it takes you to come back. And the first thing that happens, all the blood that likes to live in your legs and lower torso, it kind of floats uphill, because the gravity's not there to hold it down. So everyone's walking around with these big fat faces for the first day. Oh, yeah. They
look, is that why the visor on that is so large?
I know. That's right. But then after a day or so, you know, your kidneys catch up with you. They dump the excess blood volume. So you end up with little skinny legs, and you look normal again. But it feels...
How do you control your heart rate that first time you're on the launch pad and the classic sequence starts up? How on earth do you stop your heart rushing up your mouth and saying, oh, my God?
Well, you get trained a lot. So we spend, you know, before launch, you've done about 60 runs in the simulator for a launch countdown and all the rest of it.
Nothing can prepare you for that. Nothing.
Well, you know, it is different. The real thing is the real thing, no question. And there it is, fire and, you know, brimstone going on, you know, 100 feet below your back as all the motors kick up.
And did you walk towards the shuttle on the launch pad? Do you do that?
Yes.
We always see it in slow motion, but as you walk towards, think, this is it.
This is it. And there's that thing steaming away there, all the sort of, you know, vapors coming off it the excess propellants venting off, so it looks alive. It's a gigantic creature, you know.
And really re-entry looks like a lot of fun.
Re-entry's good too. When you look out the window, you see cherry red out through the windows.
What do you mean? What?
Well, the heat, you know, from the plasma outside. It's 3,000 degrees outside. So as you're coming belting across the Pacific, you know, at 25 times the speed of sound, there it is. It's red outside the windows from the heat, and you're doing these big S turns across the Pacific. Across the Pacific in 15 minutes, by the way. Straight across the whole ocean.
And it's bright red outside.
Bright red outside. As you're using the atmosphere as a brake, you know, to slow you down.
So,
you're looking through this red stuff. You can make out what's the Earth below, you know, through the red haze. Uh-huh. But it's hot out there.
And what can you hear?
Can't hear anything. I mean, at that point, you're buttoned up in your pressure suit. You've got a helmet on. You've got headphones and all the rest of it. So you can just hear everyone talking. The rest of it.
But you can't hear
kind of wind noise or anything like that.
Is there wind? Is there space weather, so to speak?
There is, but it's not like weather down here. Space weather is sort of particles coming out from the sun, and that kind of comes and goes with solar activity, and that's what we call space weather. And that can interfere with, you know, things like radios, communications, and stuff like that. But
there's no sensation. We hear about astral winds. That's just science fiction, is it?
Well, those particles are real, coming out from the sun.
But can't feel them, can you?
Can't feel them, but you can detect them with instruments. And, you know, sometimes when there's a solar flare, you get more of this stuff and your instruments go...
And what about when you get back, sort of readjusting? How difficult is that?
Well, it's tough, you know. The first sort of few minutes as you come back, you keep falling over because your inner ear doesn't work very well after being in space for a couple of weeks. And then you feel like, in my case, like a little old man because... You know, you're sort of floating around in space for 2 weeks. You're not using your muscles much, and then now you have to work.
Is there a sensation akin to jet lag? Is there anything like that?
It feels like you're wearing, you know, got a couple of 60-pound cement bags on your shoulders and you're walking around. So it's hard work, and then everything's falling over. You know.
And can you talk and adjust normally? I mean, Lord knows it's hard enough when you come back from a great holiday. How can you relate to people having just one of the most extraordinary things any human being can ever experience?
After you come back from your first flight, you can't stop talking. You know, you tell everybody and everybody about what it was like and how much fun it was and all the rest
What's
of it.
What's the first thing you want to impress upon people? What is
The view.
Yeah.
The view. You know, I'm seeing the world, you know, just floating below you. Just a beautiful sight. Curved, you know, all those guys were right. It's curved in both directions. It really is a big ball.
Yeah.
And it is flying around the sun. It's all true. And it's just devastatingly beautiful.
Yeah. Give us something else.
A less serious question here, but let's give it a go. When Piers is applying for car insurance online, what does he give as his occupation? I don't think I've ever seen astronaut as a listed job. Also, I wonder how the insurers work out the premium based upon risky occupations.
The idea of actually being an astronaut, do you ever get over that? Will you have to tell people, I'm an astronaut?
I did. You know, for car insurance and house insurance, it was okay. Not a problem. But for life insurance, it was no thank you very much. They were not interested at all. Eventually, NASA had to get a deal with an insurance company to get us life insurance because no insurance companies would would give us life insurance.
What about...
which is kind of tough, you know, you've got families and all the rest
of it. Of course, and you're an astronaut, there's some risk.
Who's going to feed my dog?
And what about leeway in taking personal items abroad? Do you have a... Are you allowed to take... Because every milligram must be weighed, I suspect. Are you allowed to take personal items into space?
You're allowed to take about a pound and a half of personal stuff.
So, what do you say?
So, I took, you know, little bits of jewellery for, you know, people in the family and stuff like that. I took a medal that the Royal Society wanted to give to Stephen Hawking, you know, for...
Okay.
His contribution to astronomy. So he got his medal that had been in space and back, which he liked. He says, I want to follow my medal into space, which is good. And things like that. You know, you try and take things that mean something to people.
Did you take a picture of Newton?
I did. I took a picture of Newton, and I also took a little bit of his tree.
What do you mean you took a little bit of Newton's tree?
The Royal Society gave me a little bit of his apple tree. They had a piece of his apple tree squirreled away there in Carlton Terrace, and they gave it to me, so I took it up there. And then, you know, took a picture of Newton looking at his apple tree floating, not falling, which would have fooled him a little bit, I think.
And do you, have you left anything in space? If you're out there engineering, I mean, you know, something floats away.
Something got away from me on one of my spacewalks. I was working with a spatula.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't doing, you know, short order cooking. I was trying to do some tile repair using some sticky goo, and I was hitting it with a spatula. And I had 60 spatulas, and they're all on hooks and bits of tether and stuff. And one of them snuck away and made a bid for freedom. And it floated away.
The image,
my favorite spatula.
The image one day that somebody's going to be passing it and saying, "How'd that get here? What's that?"
So, you know, everyone gave me a lot of grief about it, and I got mounted, you know, spatulas on plaques with little funny jokes and stuff. So I got a lot of that stuff at home. But then 4 months later, this U.S. Air Force lieutenant calls me up from, you know, somewhere in Colorado. He says, "Sir, your spatula has re-entered, and it's now at the bottom of the Atlantic." "I just think you should know." And that's it. "Well, thank you very much, Lieutenant."
I know, I bet there's
he said, "Just doing my duty." Then he went,
"I bet there's about 20 websites saying, I saw it, this spatula came down to Earth. You know, they're trying to get in touch with us."
Yeah.
Well, Piers, we're out of time, and it has been one of the most extraordinary things and honours, I think, to meet someone who's done something so few people have. And it's nice to know that your perspective on it as well, you think, yeah, pretty cool. It's not, it isn't your 9-to-5, and I don't think there's another job like it, and there's not another hope like it as well for what people like you do. And it's extraordinary to me that that we decide we don't want to do that when we want to do so many other things that don't have an impact or indeed a vision like what you've dedicated your life to. It's absolutely extraordinary, and it's good to hear someone who's got, you know, that kind of take upon it. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very
much.
Me too.
Good words and many thanks.
Thank you very much indeed. Piers Sellers, British/American astronaut, but we'll claim you for now.
Yeah. There you go.
If you get to the moon, little Union Jack wouldn't be so bad. Thank you very much indeed, my friend.
And
here's the cricket, everybody.